Protests continue in Egypt in advance of voting on a new constitution. Why are protesters saying it does not represent the hope inspired by the Arab Spring? River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Politics Day here on River to River, today with an international focus. We get analysis on the situation in Egypt. Also, why NATO fears the Syrian president may use chemical weapons for his own people, and the implications of a North Korean missile test. My guests today, Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, Mahmoud Hamid of Drake University. Join our discussion as we put international politics in the spotlight after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Wednesday here on the program, and today we decide to take an international focus and look at political happenings around the world as they affect U.S. foreign policy and us here in the United States. Helping us do that today, Jim McCormick, Chair and Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. He's in our Ames studio. Hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me back.
Great to have you. In our Des Moines studio, we have Mahmoud Hamid. He is Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University in our Des Moines studio. Mahmoud, welcome.
Good to be back.
And we want to talk about a number of political developments outside of the United States to see their effects on the country and on our country and on the world. And River to River listeners, what are your thoughts and questions? During the hour, note this number, this contact information. If you have thoughts, questions, concerns about our topics, Egypt, developments in Syria, North Korea, Pakistan, 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us during the hour at IPR Talk. Let's start off with Syria. President Obama yesterday announced the decision for the U.S. to formally recognize the Syrian opposition who are fighting President Bashar al-Assad.
We've made a decision that the Syrian opposition coalition is now inclusive enough, is reflective and representative enough of the Syrian population that we consider them the legitimate representative of the Syrian people. In opposition to the Assad regime, and so we will provide them recognition, and obviously with that recognition comes responsibilities.
President Obama, in an interview yesterday with ABC News' Barbara Walters, formal recognition, a big step, especially since some of those involved in opposing the Assad regime are affiliated with al-Qaeda in Iraq. The President Obama says, though, the U.S. will make the clear distinction between those two groups. In an interview on a flight to Kuwait, Defense Secretary Leon Panetta was asked about reports that the Syrian regime was preparing chemical weapons to use against his own people.
At this point, the intelligence has really kind of leveled off. We haven't seen anything new indicating, any aggressive steps to move forward in that way. But we continue to monitor it very closely, and we continue to make clear to them that they should not, under any means, make use of these chemical weapons against their own population. That would produce serious consequences. I'd like to believe he's got the message. We've made it pretty clear, and others have as well. But it's also clear that the opposition continues to make gains in Syria. And our concern is that if they feel like the regime is, threatened with collapse, that they might resort to these kinds of weapons.
U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta on a flight to Kuwait yesterday. A couple of the sound bites we have in the news concerning Syria. Let's talk about Syria a little bit. Two aspects here, the formal recognition and the fear of use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. Jim McCormick, may I hand it off to you first of all, and let's talk about formal recognition. What is the significance of President Obama doing that yesterday?
Well, I think what it does, of course, is to increase the legitimacy of the opposition in the, sort of the global arena, although sort of the United States is not the first to do this. Some of our European allies, some of the Gulf states have already given recognition to the opposition group. But I think throwing American weight behind that, you know, obviously is important. I think there is a threshold here that we ought to keep in mind, though. We are not saying that that this opposition group that we've recognized is really the state of Syria yet. I mean, they couldn't take over the embassy and so on in Washington and that sort of thing. But I think what it does do is to open up other states to provide avenues of resources. We have said our official policy is humanitarian aid. I believe personally that we probably have an intelligence finding with covert operations and in terms of providing some hardware, not maybe not directly, but through, say, Saudi Arabia or through Turkey. So I think this ratchets it up, you know, one step here. And then Secretary Panetta's statement, of course, tries to sort of ramp down what the Syrian government might do. So I think it's symbolic. But it also could lead to some substantive change.
Mm-hmm. Mahmoud, tell us, what do we know about the Syrian opposition there? The mention there that President Obama says he'll make a clear distinction between the two groups, the opposition, some affiliated with al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's worrying.
It is worrying, and I think this is part of the hesitancy on part of the U.S. administration to recognize the Syrian opposition early on. I think the administration is torn between its desire to see al-Assad regime go and its hesitancy about who is going to replace this regime and how this is going to affect the overall stability in the region and principally Israel's security. What we know about the opposition is that they don't have much command system. They are pretty much regional opposition. They are trying to create a political front. We are yet to see how much this political front actually have control on the ground. Remember, in Syria right now, the war has been going on for about 20 months. More than 40,000 Syrians, and this is the conservative estimate, lost their lives. So for many Syrians, anyone who is stepping in to help is a friend. It does not matter whatever their ideological persuasions might be. And that is why you see in Syria today all shades of nationalistic and religious opposition to the Assad regime.
Do we know, have any sense of how big a portion of the opposition is affiliated with al-Qaeda in Iraq?
The estimates we have is that puts those as a very small number, but they are nonetheless effective part. Those guys are hardened soldiers. They knew how to fight such a guerrilla warfare, city warfare. And they are willing to take extreme measures to put pressure on the Assad regime. So they are small in number, but large in effect.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Jim, going back to you, what's at stake for us here in the U.S. and the larger international community as we watch the worrying developments in Syria?
Well, I think this is really part of this whole Arab Spring that the administration has been really much supporting. I mean, across northern Africa, from Tunisia, you know, through Egypt and Syria. And I think we're really concerned, as was pointed out here, about who follows on in Assad's footsteps if he is replaced here. I mean, we have difficulties with regard to Egypt, which we'll probably get to. But, I mean, you know, these other Arab Spring countries have turned in an Islamic direction. And I think there's really a concern about what that holds in terms of the future. The other thing, of course, and was also mentioned, is with regard to any kind of efforts to get a peace settlement in the Middle East. You know, not only goes through Egypt, but it also goes through Syria here. I mean, ultimately with the Golan Heights and the West Bank and Palestinian Authority. So, you know, a Syrian government.
For those of us not intimately aware of that geography, tell us a little bit about that as it connects to the Palestinian Israel. problem.
Well, in 1967, in the Six-Day War, the territories that were seized were the Golan Heights, were the from Syria, the West Bank, from Jordan, Gaza from Egypt, and so on. So, you know, those are all critical players in there. Now, there were a couple agreements made with regard to withdrawing from the Sinai, in particular, and in the the peace treaty with Egypt. But now a change in government in Egypt at least raises some doubt about that. Although the Morsi government so far has said that they'll continue on, there was some pullback with regard to Syria in terms of the Golan Heights, but that remains an issue. And and just in terms of the proximity, they're border to border there, if you will. And that is also crucial in terms of the outcome. The larger question, of course, is because Syria also has a tie to Iran, those things are, we're really getting, they're all interconnected here. And so that's why a Syrian government that would be agreeable or at least workable in terms of a Palestinian-Israeli settlement would be very, very much in the interest of the United States, as well, as I said earlier, this larger issue of will the Arab Spring yield democratic regimes in the region.
Mm-hmm. Back to the question, the worry over chemical weapons being used as weapons of mass destruction. Mahmoud, do you think the international community, the U.S. along with partners, has made it clear enough to Bashar al-Assad that would be a clear line they do not want to cross? Or do you see that President Assad at this point may see that he already has nothing to lose and may try to unleash those weapons?
That's a critical question, and I think the Assad regime is kind of torn. This is like the last-ditch weapon for them if they seem to be losing the war. I don't think we are at that moment yet. The estimates I received and the phone calls I made to people in Syria basically states that the regime has put much of its fighting force in Damascus and around Damascus. The estimates I have is something like 70,000 soldiers. Most of them are Alawites, the religious group of the president. The opposition made significant success on the ground lately. But we are not there yet that the regime is collapsing and losing control of the capital. If we are at that moment, I think this is the litmus test, if the Assad regime is going to use chemical weapons or not. I hope that they get the message that this is a red line. If they cross it, there will be consequences. The Assad, however, understands that we are not in a hurry to get our men and women in any kind of battle in Syria. So I think the administration, NATO, and our European allies need to basically show what does this would mean. Maybe some kind of air raids against chemical depots might deliver a stronger message. But we are not there yet. Maybe this is in the future.
Mahmoud Hummad is with us, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, along with Jim McCormick, Chair and Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. This is an internationally focused edition of Politics Wednesday here on River to River. We'll invite you to tell us what stories on the international stage you're following closely, are concerned about. What areas of the world are you most concerned about? 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook, or tweet us at IPR Talk. We mentioned Egypt a couple of times. Let's focus on that for the next couple of minutes. The protest movement against the controversial draft constitution appears to be losing steam after a lackluster turnout last night. As reported by NPR this morning, opposition leaders had called for mass demonstrations. They're scrambling to decide whether to boycott Saturday's referendum on this constitution. Jim, remind us, what are the people protesting here exactly?
Well, the concern is that this new constitution would sort of enshrine into law not only democratic processes, but also Islamic processes. And I think that the concern is about fundamental rights. And given that the whole – and we're almost at 2 years. I was thinking about this before the program started. We're almost at a two-year juncture because it was late January 2011 when these kind of first demonstrations started in Cairo. And, of course, the toppling of Mubarak in February. And so there's a concern that that whole effort over the last 2 years will be lost if this constitution is really put into place and there's this movement to Sharia law and particularly in terms of some fundamental rights and rights of women here.
Mm-hmm. Mahmoud, how do you see the demonstrations and the referendum on the constitution Saturday?
I disagree a bit. I don't see anything new in this constitution regarding Islamization of the state. Article 2 that Jim might be referring to existed since 1971 and in the current form does exist in the Egyptian constitution since 1980. I don't think that people in the street are protesting because of the content of the constitution. I think they disagree mainly about the process. The process at the previous rulers of Egypt, the army generals, put it together was flawed from the beginning. After Mubarak removal, there was a vacuum of power, and there were different approaches. Many of the revolutionaries wanted to get a constitution written soon and then have election. The SCAF, the army command, who was in control, wanted to stay in power longer. And to achieve this, they put a different roadmap, which started by organizing elections for the parliament, and then the parliament would elect a constituent assembly to draft a new constitution. Mm-hmm. The problem, however, is that the results of the parliamentary election last year and early this year brought a huge, something like 70% at the lower house, more than this in the upper house, of Islamist party. So if we will follow the democratic procedure, those Islamist party has the right to pick the 100-member committee to draft the constitution. And they did so. And their selection did not appease many of the revolutionaries or the secular forces. So the court stepped in and basically said, your selection is wrong. The parliament accepted this verdict and they drafted a new, they selected a new committee, which was the one that just finished the new constitution. The new constitution basically is very, very similar to the French constitution of the Fifth Republic that we have today, mm-hmm. the division of powers.
So you do not – I want to go to a caller quickly before the break, but you don't see, Mahmoud, problems in the hopes raised by the Arab Spring in these latest developments.
The problem about the constitution itself or –
Of a more democratic Egypt and a more democratic Arab world.
If democracy means, among other things, the division of powers among different different authorities of the state, the presidency, the prime minister, the parliament, and the judiciary, this constitution is way more democratic than anything that Egypt had in history. If democracy, however, means that a constitution that would appease everyone, that will never happen.
Okay. Jim, before we go to that caller, anything to add to what Mahmoud just said?
Well, I'm happy to have that sort of clarification about the litany of the process here. But I guess I would, you know, certainly the process is important. But it seems to me that some, at least the kind of demonstration that we've seen, there's a concern over the content of it as well.
Okay. David is with us in the Quad Cities. David, what's on your mind in international affairs today?
Well, the Middle East is, I have a grandson that lives in Jordan. And I've been to Syria, Israel and Jordan. I'm not an expert on that area, but I see this Arab Spring as really, I always think of the analogy to the American Revolution. In the Arab Spring, I see that it's going to take a long time to become totally democratic, and it may not look like we want it to look from our perspective. I mean, we were backing dictators in that area for decades, and I think we need to take the long-term perspective that this democratic process needs to take place, and we need to maybe at times help but not intervene. And that's a balancing act, I think, that is really difficult to do. But if we take a long-term approach, it will sort itself out as long as they're moving toward democracy. Mm-hmm. That's my comment.
David, before we get reaction to your comment, maybe we ask what your grandson does in Jordan.
Well, actually, he's a child, and...
Okay. He plays a lot, we hope.
He's 7 years old.
Okay. David.
My son works for the State Department.
Thank you very much for that comment, observation, David, in the Quad Cities. So, yeah, in our 24/7 news cycle, back in our revolution, we didn't have that sort of news cycle. Now, did we, Jim?
No, we did not. I think he makes a very, very good point. I mean, when I talk about the development of democracies, you know, we talk about institutions and constitutions. And obviously those are important in terms of how things are done. But really what you have to create, and that's what he's really talking about, is a political culture that will accept the, sort of the rules of the game. And that does take much more time. And that's what had to happen in the American experience, too, in terms of creating a political culture that would tolerate, some of the differences that were even outlined in the Constitution. And that's a great transformation. I just wanted to add one other thing.
Sure.
Why we're concerned about, why the U.S. is concerned, at least from my perspective in terms of foreign policy, is that we're obviously concerned about Egypt's role with regard to the peace treaty with the Israelis and an eventual settlement. And I think that's why the administration has been, they see Morsi as pretty pragmatic, and particularly with the fighting and the exchanges that occurred between Hamas and Israelis. The U.S. government was actually pleased with Morsi's sort of pragmatism and trying to dampen down, I guess, that conflict.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, Mahmoud, it's been said so many times over the few decades, the hopes raised for Middle East peace. Do you see any combination with the change in Egypt that could lead on to a path to real long-term peace in the Middle East?
Not anytime soon. I don't think the changes in Egypt, Jim is correct, the changes in Egypt is not going to produce a major change. I think the Morsi regime has many times said they are committed to the peace with Israel. It might not be as a warm peace as with Mubarak, but the peace is going to continue. Morsi, of course, needs to show some support for the people in Gaza, and he did. And I think the Egypt foreign policy in the last few months has been a balancing act. The problem with the peace in the Middle East is the lack of a balance of power between the two sides. Remember, Syria now, there will be no negotiations for the foreseeable future because Israel can legitimately make the case that with whom should we negotiate?
Of course.
On the Palestinian side, you see the divisions as well. And you see, as an addition to this, there is no real push among the Israeli public to go into any peace negotiations anytime soon. In the past 10 or 20 years, you see more moderation on many of the Arab publics and more extreme in among the Israeli public. You see parties who traditionally used to be in the far right becoming center stage in Israel. Regardless of what happens in the Arab Spring, there will be no breakthrough anytime soon.
Okay. We'll be back with more from Mahmoud Hamad, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University, Jim McCormick, Chair and Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Politics Wednesday here with an international...
And after you got on, I remember you coming in on another show.
International Focus. We'll be back in just a moment. Talk about North Korea as well, and maybe Pakistan. And a surprise at the end of the program for you beer lovers as well. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. So good to have you with us on this edition of River to River over the noon hour on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, after this year's November election, where voters in Colorado and Washington voted to make marijuana legal for recreational use, people in Iowa are proposing similar legislation, specifically two bills being proposed in the Iowa legislature, one making medical marijuana legal in the state, and one decriminalizing the possession of small amounts of the substance. Tomorrow on this program, we'll speak with those promoting the increased legality of marijuana here in Iowa and those against any kind of legalization, and we'll find out take a try to find out how much support there would be for this in the legislature. Tomorrow on this program, marijuana, possibility of legalization. Today on the program, Politics Wednesday, and we turn our gaze outward today to politics outside the United States and how they affect us here in Iowa, in the United States. Here to do that with us, Mahmoud Hamad. He is Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at Drake University. Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, where he is chair and a professor of political science. We were talking mainly in the first half hour about Egypt, Syria, developments there. We'd like to have your input. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go right to the callers, if we could. Let's try out Bob in Des Moines. Our conversation in the first half hour stirred up what thoughts from you, Bob?
I heard some of the questions about constitution writing and so forth.
In Egypt, yes.
In Egypt, yes. And I also have one question about Bahrain. About constitution writing, I don't think our time in 200 years ago should be the example we should be on. I think people should be learning from what has been done since, and hundreds of constitutions have been written since then, and I think people should be trying to build on what's at its best level and copying now. And the second thing I want to ask about Egypt is there any chance we'll ever stop paying them to not, fight with Israel? I mean, why do we have to pay nations to, just have peace for themselves?
Okay.
And one last question about Bahrain is it was quite an embarrassment for us to just sit the way we did when people were getting slaughtered over there, while we were promoting democracy and the rest of the Middle East. And I just wondered what happened to the people of Bahrain now. And I think it's kind of a hypocrisy when we say that we like democracy, but when people rise up, we just say nothing if the people on top seem like our allies.
Bob, a lot to chew on there. A few questions. We'll try to get at least some brief comments about each of yours. Let's talk about international aid to Egypt, paid also to Israel and Egypt. I think I'm not sure of the exact numbers now, but Jim McCormick, the reason for that aid and why it continues?
Well, the original sort of agreement in terms of striking the peace deal emanates from Camp David, and the arrangement was that Israel would get $3 billion in aid, and Egypt gets the equivalent in various forms of about $2 billion. There's been some slight adjustment, but that's been the sort of pattern for over the last several decades here, and it was part of the inducement, frankly, in terms of getting an agreement, even earlier in terms of some of the withdrawal from the Sinai as well for the Israelis. I mean, there was other part of the deal was not to recognize the PLO until they accepted the State of Israel, the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO. So there's a bit of history here, and it is really coupled to the effort to maintain peace in the region. The larger issue, I mean, I don't want to dismiss this, is in terms of development, particularly on the Egyptian side.
Okay. Perhaps I can hand the Bahrain question off to you, Mahmoud. There was some uprising in Bahrain. Remind us what's going on there.
Okay. Can I just comment on the aid first, just briefly?
Yes.
Egypt gets about $1.5 billion in the last few years of aid, worth of aid. Most of this aid, however, is military aid, which basically sees to continue the trend in the Egyptian army of using U.S. equipment, send Egyptian personnel to be trained here. So it is not only about the peace with Israel. It's partially about creating friends in important places in the Middle East. The same happens in our aid to Pakistan and other countries. As for Bahrain, I think I agree with Bob. The Bahrain is one of the failures of the Arab Spring, the U.S. administration, and the region as a whole. What basically happened is that the majority in Bahrain are Shia. The ruling family is Sunni. Bahrain is member to the GCC, the Gulf Cooperation Council. Bahrain is the most open, one of the most open places in the Gulf. And when the uprising took place, the Saudi royal family basically drew the red line. They don't want to see any uprisings in the Arabian Peninsula, and that's why Saudi Arabia basically sent forces along with other GCC countries to quell the protests. What happened since is that you see sporadic protests every now and then, because the root causes of the anger, of the popular anger, is still there. You have an unelected monarchy that basically controls every aspect. The majority of the population is suffering economically and politically because of this. The problem, however, is that we mean the United States, basically care too much for Saudi Arabia and its security because of oil.
Also, there isn't Bahrain the base of the U.S. Fifth Fleet there.
Yeah, that's correct. So and the current royal family has been on our side for extended period of time. The problem is if we allow, or if the uprising is to be successful in changing the regime, we most likely are going to end up with a regime very similar to the regime in Iraq. By this, I mean a regime that is dominated by the Shia majority, a regime that allies itself with Iran, and that is going to disturb the balance of power in the region. And that is why I see the hesitancy among regional players, as well as the United States, to support the uprising in Bahrain.
Okay, let's go to Abid. I hope, Abid, I have your name correctly pronounced.
Yes.
In Des Moines.
Yes.
Abid?
Yes. Well, I have a general comment, and I think the U.S. foreign policy should do the right thing, which is to not intervene in other people's business. Let them sort it out themselves. See, the point is that if we go and break open a prison and free the inmates, then the inmates don't automatically become our friends. The big example is that, like Al-Qaeda and Taliban, they are creations of the United States. And we will create more Al-Qaedas and more Taliban by going around and intervening in other people's business.
Abed, thank you very much for that, Jim. Of course, that a concern, weighing all the issues in Washington about intervention in Syria or elsewhere.
Sure. I mean, that is a driving force about how much to intervene and how much to sort of stand on the sidelines and, you know, get also comments that, you know, we're not doing enough. I mean, sometimes the United States, you know, really is in a very difficult position, because if it doesn't act, you know, some of its friends and allies saying, you know, you're standing on the sidelines. But he certainly has a valid kind of point. I mean, I don't think that we do have interests, and we have to make certain that we support those kind of interests. I mean, it's the same point about Bahrain that you were just speaking to. I mean, the issue over having the American naval port there, it seems to be as crucial given the location of Bahrain.
Okay, let's go to Ed in Iowa City. Ed, we're coming up on the end of this segment, but what's your question?
My question involves Iran. With the sanctions on Iran, if Iran wants those sanctions to be removed, as certainly they will, at what point can the United States and the EU and the Security Council give? What can they give Iran to let Iran feel that it wins with enough stuff so that the EU, the United States, and the UN feels like they win?
Okay.
What is a viable middle point?
A good compromise. How do you see that, Mahmoud Hamad?
Remove economic sanctions, let Iranian trade come to the region and elsewhere. Stop putting pressure on the Iranian leadership.
This is your recommendation?
Nope. This is what the Iranian want to see.
Okay.
I I would not recommend doing any of that right now. Iran is going to see a change of guard in the next year. Ahmadinejad is stepping down because of the term limit in Iran. He has not been the most helpful leader in engaging with the international community. Hopefully, we're going to see a more moderate voice at the presidential palace in Iran, a person that the Obama administration or the EU and the regional players can deal with. We need to take into consideration that if Syria goes, Iran is going to be left with very, very little friends in the region. Syria has been Iran's best friend. Syria was the only Arab country that took Iran's side during the Iran-Iraq war. And if Syria goes, that is going to put pressure on the only ally left, which is Hezbollah in Lebanon. So we're going to see a changing behavior, hopefully, in Iran because of the changes in the on the ground anytime soon.
Just a minute or two before we end this discussion, but I wanted to pass you, Jim, the question about we talk so much about the fiscal cliff here. You must have been thinking about the implications for U.S. foreign policy. Should we go over the fiscal cliff? What would that be?
Well, I think we're already seeing it. I mean, the big move that the United States has done is sort of pivot towards Asia on this because, you know, we may have the will to do some things, although that's waning, as one of the callers said. But, you know, the wallet issue is really the problem for us. I want to just comment on this Iranian situation because
sure.
the caller really says what's the tipping point here on both sides? Well, you know, the bargaining, and I think the European Union would be very favorable to this, and probably the Obama administration would follow on. And that is if inspectors were really allowed back into Iran on a comprehensive kind of basis here. And that there would be this public renunciation. I guess I'm a little less optimistic that the change in leadership will mean a change in a more forthcoming policy with regard to Iran.
Mm-hmm. Mahmoud, any closing comments before we say goodbye?
I think the region is evolving and developing. Democracy does not mean that people are going to select the right leader all the time. We know from our history here in the United States that has not been the case. The problem I see in the region is that many of the Arab public is basically believe that democracy is going to bring an end to all their social, economic, and political problem. And this expectations is the driving force behind all the unrests that we saw and we're going to see, because no democratic government can clear the mess socially, economically, and politically that dictatorship has created in the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm. What do you expect, very quickly, what do you expect, Mahmoud and Jim, this weekend in regards to the draft constitution referendum?
I expect that they'll probably delay it unless there's really some compromise. I mean, because the opposition, you know, has not clearly decided whether they're going to boycott or vote no. But, Mahmoud, I'd be interested in your...
Yeah, the opposition today came out and said they would vote no. They asked their followers to go. My guess, do you know political science, like me and Jim, are rarely willing to make any guesses because we are almost all wrong. But yeah. My guess is that my prediction is that the constitutional referendum is going to go forward. We are not going to know the results on the 15th because they're going to have a second round of voting for different parts of Egypt on the 22nd or the 17th. My prediction is that it's going to pass with a slim majority, which is going to create more problems.
Okay, Mahmoud Hamad, thank you very much. Of Drake University,
thank
Jim
you.
McCormick of Iowa State University, it's been a pleasure having you with us for this
much.
Hour. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And finally today, this the 12th day of the 12th month of 2012, not a day of deliverance, but of delivery for devout American fans of Westerlitteren 12, a beer brewed by the reclusive Belgian monks at Sixtus Abbey. The celebrated beer, often called the best in the world, is usually only available for sale at the Abbey, located in the Belgian countryside. But today, buyers in the United States and other countries, and here in Iowa, can purchase the beer at select retailers. You get six bottles, two chalices, for about $85. Joining me now, Frederick Boudwani, the owner of Abu Nawas Beverage Company in Elkader, Iowa, just one of a handful of U.S. distributors who got his hands on this rare Belgian beer. Welcome to our program, Frederick.
Good morning, Ben. Thanks for having me.
How did you manage to get a line on this very rare beer?
Honestly, it's I lead my life by passion, so whatever I do, I'm very passionate about, and I think people in the beer world really sense that and kind of reward you accordingly. Call it karma if you wish, but we have it in Iowa. It's kind of amazing.
Tell us why the Monks decided to make this release outside of Belgium, and I understand it's a one-time release only.
Correct. It's once in a lifetime. Monks being monks, they're really particular about making money. In fact, even at the Abbey, it's kind of quite an endeavor to be able to put your hands on the beer. So you have to call this number, and it goes for months on without that phone line being answered. And if you're lucky, one day they pick up the phone, they tell you exactly what's available, what you're going to get, how many you're going to get, and what price you're going to pay for it. And if you're one of those lucky ones, you'll be able to get the beer. So it's kind of amazing that we're able to get it here in our backyards. But to go back to your question, the only reason why this beer is being released this year is because the Abbey is in need of a roof, and that's the only reason they released the beer to raise the money for the new roof.
Mm-hmm. So they are selling it based on that, and once they have that money, and they've evidently calculated it, that's all they want. They have some a vow of poverty, perhaps.
Absolutely, and it's kind of amazing. In fact, we're really appreciative of all our retailers here because nobody's making any money on this whole sale. Everybody is putting an incredible amount of energy and effort and resources into this project, and I think everybody is donating their time and their effort for that purpose. Starting by the importer, the distributors, and the retailers.
And you're the distributor. In Iowa, there are only four retailers that have it available, correct?
Correct.
That would be Shara's Restaurant there in Elkader, Ben's in Cedar Rapids, John's Grocery in Iowa City, and a Des Moines retailer as well.
The Royal Mile in Des Moines. Thanks to Jeff Bruning at the Royal Mile. Like I said, I really would like to reiterate, because after they process their credit cards, they are probably losing money on this thing, and I want to make sure that they get kudos for what they're doing, because it's a worthy endeavor helping these monks raise the money for their project.
Now, I actually got my hands on one of these packages this morning when we heard the news. together with my executive producer, Catherine Perkins, rushed off to John's Grocery Store. They had delivered to them 80 of these packages, 6 bottles, 2 chalices, and they had 5 left. They couldn't promise to keep one there, so you have to be 1 per person. So they are most likely gone by now.
We just received a call from Colorado, somebody begging if we could ship it to him, and I said, if you can be here by 8 o'clock tonight, I'll promise you we can get you one. But shipping it is really we gonna have to prioritize. Why Iowa finds itself really lucky is because none of the neighboring states really got it. So we've been getting a lot of calls from outside of states as well.
What other states? How many people have been calling you? What other states?
A lot of Wisconsin, a lot of Nebraska, a lot of Missouri, a lot of Colorado. It's been kind of crazy. And it goes to show that beer world is kind of a beast on its own. The people that are in it are really passionate about what they do and what they get, and West Verlitteren 12 in the world of beer is the holy grail. It is considered the best thing ever made.
I wonder, Frederick, if you can describe the beer that we can expect to pleasure our palates, this Vester Verlitteren.
So it's a strong Belgian Abbey Ale, very robust, a lot of dry fruit, higher alcohol content, and really, really delicious. That's the best I can tell you about. Make sure when you're drinking it with your friends, raise your glass to the monks and their project, and to Abu Nawas Beverage Company, because it was a lot of energy and effort making this project happen. In fact, once it got here into Iowa, I couldn't wait to get it outside of our warehouse, because it was such such a pressure.
How many, being
what it is.
How many of these packages did you have total in your warehouse?
There was about 70 cases, and each case had 4 packages.
Frederic Boudwani, owner of Abu Nawas Beverage Company in El Cater, thank you very much, and good. I don't have to wish you good luck. I think having your retailers get rid of this, it's probably already gone.
Thank you very much. Thanks for your call, and I appreciate it.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Help and aims from Alyssa Weiss in Des Moines, from John Pemble. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Join us tomorrow. Thanks for joining us.